As I mentioned, the Duluth Art Institute is throwing a big party tonight to celebrate three separate art openings. And one of them kind of intrigued me. Well, they all kind of intrigued me. But I wanted to find out a little bit more. Jean Birkenstein, or is it, Robin, is it Birkenstein?
Birkenstein.
It's Birkenstein. Okay, so we're getting to you in just a moment. Jean Birkenstein is one of the artists whose work is going to be featured. And the more we read about her, the more interesting a person she seems to be. Her son is Robin Washington, and he's here in the studios this morning to tell us a little bit about his mom, an artist, a teacher, a leader of the civil rights movement, an ocelot.
Actually, we called him ocelot. Both pronunciations are okay. But when you have one, I think you have a little more privilege of what you want to call them, right?
Exactly. But regardless, you had one.
Yes, yes.
When did you start to figure out that you were not growing up in a conventional family?
Before we got the ocelot. We actually had a tarantula, some pet alligators, although a lot of people have them. And, of course, this summer in Chicago, this was all in Chicago, they had an alligator problem, right? So, but anyway.
They do now. But, thanks to your family.
No. Ours didn't get out.
Well, and of course, this was, you know, we're talking about the 50s and 60s when people had a slightly, you know, we weren't paying as much attention to what they call exotic pets and that sort of thing.
Right.
Now there's a greater sensibility about that, and they wouldn't be necessarily encouraging alligators or...
Well, rather than jumping back to this story, why we got them, I'll come back to. We got them as a watch cat. We wanted our house was getting broken into, and we will come back to why that was happening. But this is just downtown near north side of Chicago, where my family has been for generations, actually. And so in any case, we had a family meeting, and we said, well, we need to get some kind of ferocious animal. I said, a dog? Well, no. Dogs, you find a steak, and you throw it somewhere, and they go run after the steak.
Okay.
So they're not very reliable.
Okay.
So I said, how about a lion or a tiger? We always had
cats.
How
old were you at the time that you made this suggestion?
This was 1968, so I was about 12.
Okay. All right.
Yep.
Okay.
And my mother said, no, you can't have, they're illegal. Now, she actually was wrong. As you just said, back then, it wasn't illegal to have a lion or tiger in Chicago. Thank goodness she thought it was, because if she didn't, we probably would have gotten one. She said they're too big.
Okay.
And so then we went through other cats, and as you'll see in the exhibit, she was very much a cat person. We had many cats. So we went down the species, and a jaguar, well, they're pretty big, a leopard, cheetah. I like the idea of a cheetah, you know, to run with.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Right, but they're still pretty
large. You would have been the star of the track team, too.
And so she said, how about an ocelot? I said, what's an ocelot? She said, it's like a dwarf jaguar, and it's about 2.5 feet long, a foot and a half tall. And I said, that's it. I want an ocelot. The next day, there was an ad in the paper in the Chicago Sun-Times, ocelot, $175. That was Elgato, and we got him.
All right, I just got to know, yes or no, before we move to the art, I just got to know, did anybody try to break in after you got him?
Yeah, actually, they did. And one time...
And what did he do? Did he do his job, or did he...
He did do his job.
...act like many cats and just kind of look?
No. He did his job better, really. I mean, he wasn't just supposed to go attack or anything like that. He was highly intelligent and knew that two kids hanging off the back porch, which is what was happening, would be a challenge for him. So he ran toward me, and he kept turning his body around real quick. And basically...
So it was kind of like Timmy's Fallen in the Well.
Yeah.
But the cat version.
Right.
Okay.
Except yours truly was too stupid to know what he was doing. I thought, Gato, what are you doing? Why are you turning around like that? You know, are you having a flashback to the jungle?
And he's looking at you like,
you idiot. Finally, I go over there, and they see these two kids, and they jump off the porch. So,
all right.
Yeah. But we had a sign that said, beware of cat. And it was a novelty sign, but it was literal in our
But
case.
It worked.
Yes.
Your mom... She, you know, again, as the introduction said, she was a civil rights leader. She was a teacher. Your home was a safe house, was a community center for rival gangs. She got them involved in art. What was that like?
So my family's African American and Jewish. My mother was Jewish and not black. My father was black and not Jewish. I say that carefully because you can be both, and that's what I am, 100% of each.
And they fell madly in love because they had so much in common.
Well, they did have a lot in common. They were very left-leaning. They both had, were attending Roosevelt College at the time, which was a very rather left-leaning institution, and was her third college she was going to. She originally went to Middlebury in Vermont, and then to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and then she was picking up education credits, met my father. They also knew Harold Washington, by the way, who later became mayor of Chicago, the first black mayor. And they met in a case of mistaken identity, and it may have had something to do with Harold. I met Harold Washington, I don't want to waste too much time on this, but years later at a journalist convention, he and I were in the elevator together. I was going to interview him. And I said, by the way, I'm Gene and Atlee Washington's son. And he goes, Atlee Washington, ha, 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 ha. And he laughs the entire elevator ride. I never know what it's about. He gets off. I don't get the interview, and he dies 2 months later.
Oh, no.
Right. But both my parents were very active, again, in left wing and civil rights circles. My mother became an officer of Chicago CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, and the NAACP. She co-wrote a kind of seminal study, called De Facto Segregation in Chicago Public Schools in 1958. It was published in the NAACP Crises magazine, and it really is identifying de facto segregation in the North as the next battle after de jure segregation in the South has been overturned, or partially anyway, with Brown versus Board of Education. So it was really redirecting the movement to the North. Not saying this article did it, but it was saying, hey, here's what segregation looks like in the North.
In the North.
Pretty bad. And so she wrote that, by the way. She did the research while she was on maternity leave with me. So she was involved in many activities, really always had been most of her life. And in 1960, there was a wade-in at Rainbow Beach in Chicago. It was a beach on the south side of Chicago that was unofficially, but very much so, segregated. And so the various activists held something, a wade-in rather than a sit-in. I remember it. I was 3 years old, and it was a lot of fun, and it actually worked. We desegregated Rainbow Beach. The Vice Lords and the Cobras were two gangs in Chicago. At the time, she taught at a high school where in their neighborhood on the west side of Chicago. They heard about her organizing or activity of the wade-in, and they approached her with the idea that she could be an ambassador to the establishment, to the Board of Education, to whoever they had to deal with.
Right.
And so she took the challenge. She became sort of personal neutral territory, so she could walk Vice Lords home through Cobra territory and vice versa. And she turned our house into a safe haven or a neutral meeting ground of Vice Lords and Cobras. Jet Magazine wrote about it. You can see the entire article at the exhibit. Teacher Crusades for Teen Gangs. Getting to the Ocelot, by the way. One thing about when you have gangs at your house is, quite seriously with her, is, and this is a point throughout her life, but particularly in her art, is she looked at them all as people and, respected their dignity and what they were going through and that they needed a voice. And if she could help, she would do that. She also painted them and taught them to paint. And as far as I know, I grew up with all this art, with all these paintings. Obviously, her name's not a household name yet, but it may be becoming. And but I do think that her art is of significance, if for nothing else, that the gang series she painted in different series, cat series, gang series, the view across the street from our house was a series she painted every year, or she painted every year in that series. The gang series has got to be very unusual because I don't know, I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but I don't know of any other representation of gang members as people. If you say art in gangs, you usually see graffiti.
Right.
But to
or
show
or maybe
them,
you would see some journalistic-y photographs, perhaps,
well, of much of that,
gang
right.
members looking...
Like gang members.
Like gang members, you know, looking, you know, kind of fulfilling the stereotype of being terrifying people,
right.
you know, somehow.
Right.
She was able to get them to explore art themselves, not
Absolutely.
Just paint them,
right.
but get them painting
right.
also.
Right.
And now,
or other forms of art.
I gather that kind of in conjunction with this, the idea is this is something that's going to be going on in the community with an idea of a year-long program through the Duluth Art Institute to get more kids of color to be using art to express their point of view and to kind of give voice to their voice visually, if that makes any sense.
Correct, and not just kids of color. So we this is something the staff came up with, in particular our executive director, Christina Woods. I am on the board. I am, this full disclosure, I'm the president of the board of the Duluth Art Institute. Christina heard that I was, you know, had this whole exhibit sitting around or all these paintings, said, well, you know, why don't we do something with them?
Exactly.
I guess that makes sense, and saw them, as did Amy Barsek, our curator, and who did a fabulous job in hanging it. But in any case, she was inspired, Christina was, by the stories I was telling, I guess, about my mother, and came up with it. Frankly, I was a little embarrassed by this, but hey, it's taken a life of its own. The Berkenstein Arts Movement to teach young people activism, if you will, and social change, their capacity to do social change through art. And again, it's middle school students is the cohort. So it's been going on for a few months now. It will go until the end of the year. And yesterday I spoke with them. They had their own little private walkthrough of the exhibit. And they've been learning all this stuff. I, in addition to where I was raised in, later met some of the the creators, I shouldn't say creators, but some of the very early, early pioneers in the civil rights movement. James Farmer, the co-founder of CORE, and George Hauser, they were around before my mother. They started CORE in 1942. I met them, got to know them. They both passed on, became very good friends with them. My most important work, as you know, I'm a journalist, is a documentary on the first Freedom Ride that took place in 1947, way before the Civil Rights Movement. And I found the survivors of that ride, put them on a bus, and had them relive their trip. So in any case, a part of it is the strategies they were using back then, formulating what became the 50s and the 60s. And as I was, Christina and Michelle Michigan, who's been running the program, were introducing me, reintroducing me to the young people, and as they were talking about the things that they had been learning, I almost thought they were repeating the words of Jim Farmer of
wow.
how do you organize, how do you start a movement,
wow.
how do you get people to do something toward change, and what is it you're looking for, too? So,
exactly.
you know, it isn't all protests. We talked about that last night. You don't just go out and protest. You say, what is it we want change? Maybe we can accomplish it many different ways.
Right.
So for me, however, I was thrown right into the protest because by the time of my consciousness, we were out doing weigh-ins.
Right,
we were,
right.
You know, and she had already, not just my mother, she was one of many, many leaders. But I don't hesitate to call her a leader because she was one who would do the planning and negotiating. Our living room was the so many meetings of CORE NAACP. In which she served, by the way, lemonade.
I am just imagining, I guess what I'm imagining is you upstairs with your siblings and you want to go down and get some snacks out of the fridge. No, I can't. Who's down there tonight?
Actually, it was quite the opposite. It wasn't at all. We would be actually in the room. And so I would be playing with whatever I was doing and just watching the meeting going on. And my brother and I would either be a part of it or running around, just playing.
Just be there something. And absorbing it.
Right. One of my fondest memories, I have to say, and then you take a break or whatever you need to do, is at the office of CORE. CORE had an office in downtown Chicago. She would be there meeting and mimeographing. The mimeograph got a lot of use, a very powerful tool at the time.
Yep.
A mimeograph, people, by the way, is sort of a personal printing press.
It's a copier that smells really, really good.
Right,
I'm just
saying. You shouldn't smell too much of that stuff. And so anyway, she'd be there making copies of leaflets and things like that and planning and organizing. I have a distinct memory of John Coltrane's My Favorite Things playing in the office as she and everybody are doing all their work and coming up with the next movement action. My brother and I are in the hallway. There's this cast iron elevator that also smells really nice. It's got, you know, thick paint, probably lead all over it, and thick black paint. And it just was very well kept and all. And we're playing around the elevator, and I hear da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I can smell that elevator today whenever I hear My Favorite
Bring
Things.
That memory back completely. We've got some activists that are going to be joining us here in the studio next, so we're going to need to take a break and get them in and get them set up. But I am thrilled that you came in to share about your amazing family and your amazing mother. I wish I could have known her. And I can't wait to talk with this cohort of students at some point, maybe this winter, about halfway through the year, and see how this project is affecting them and see what they think of this project.
You may read about it first. I think they're going to make some news.
Okay. Well, if I've got to fight my way to the head of the pack, I'll do what I can.
All right, you'll get there. You're aggressive.
Robin, thank you so very much for joining us. We'll get a link set up to your website so folks can read more about your mom. Mm-hmm. And we'll also get another link set up so folks can have the details on the art opening this evening at the Duluth Art Institute. And three separate shows are going to be celebrated tonight at that event. So it is really going to be something. Thanks again for coming in.
Thank you.
Robin Washington, our guest this morning on 103.3 KUMD.